Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody, along with my co-host, Dr. Pettus Perry. Hey, Pettus, how are you today?
I'm doing really well, Jill. I'm excited about today's show with Regina Mason.
We have quite a story on our program today in honor of Black History Month, and it is KSQD's third birthday. And it is your one-year anniversary co-hosting Be Bold America. We have so many special occasions.
It's a great day today.
Great day. Well, let's get on with the program. February is Black History Month, and our guest today will be discussing some exceptional and little-known Black history. Our program is about the life of William Grimes, the runaway slave. Written in 1825, The Life of William Grimes, the Runaway Slave, is the first fugitive slave narrative in American history. Let me repeat that. It is the first fugitive slave narrative in American history. William Grimes wrote and published his narrative on his own without deference to white editors, publishers, or sponsors. On this show, you will hear from his three times granddaughter, Regina E. Mason, and her story of her 15-year path to authenticate her ancestor's story and the intense personal sacrifices required to edit and publish a new edition and the creation of its subsequent documentary. In a new edition by Regina Mason and William Andrews, also fully contains William Grimes's book that has him speak directly to us from 196 years ago. It contains an immediacy, candor, and no-holds-barred realism unparalleled in the famous antebellum slave narratives of the period. It is a story that will make your skin prickle and crawl. Right now, our country is facing centuries-long impacts of white supremacy and racism. Understanding what slavery actually was like on the individuals who lived it, as well as on our society today, are paramount to our national discussion. Our future depends on it. Pettus, since it's your first year anniversary, would you like to introduce our guest today and kick off our topic?
I would be honored to. Regina Mason is an international speaker, author, film producer, and storyteller who believes in the extraordinary will of the human spirit. She spent 15 years researching the life of her great-great-great-grandfather, William Grimes, who first penned his life story in 1825, at a time when African-American autobiography was rare. She has shared her story on college and university campuses across the nation, as well as in the United Kingdom. Her story has been featured on RTE Radio in Ireland, on C-SPAN 2 Book TV, and on NPR's Fresh Air with host Terry Gross. She is the recipient of several awards, including the celebrated Amistad Make Us Free Award presented by the State of Connecticut's Amistad Committee. A retiree of the University of California at Berkeley, Regina resides in Oakland with her family. So we've got a local talent on today. We have big things to do. Welcome to Be Bold America, Gina.
Where's Gina? Emily's going to check out our connection here, because she did call in, and we patched her through to our board in the studio, and Emily is looking confused. So while she's talking, looking and finding Regina, that she's probably calling her again, we can talk about, you know, what's happening, I think, today. And one thing I wanted to ask Regina was what she thought about the callous and calculating movement to erase Black history, you know, the book burning, you know, that's the book, not banning, I mean. I'm a little bit off here because Emily's having to run around and find Regina. So what are your thoughts, Pettus, on what's happening in the movement right now to erase Black history?
One, it's not going to get erased. You can't erase history. That's the first thing. And there's too much out on digital media now, so it's more difficult than ever. But the other thing is you mentioned book burning, and then you corrected yourself.
I did, yes.
There was some book burning.
There was. Okay.
I believe it was in Tennessee.
So I didn't misspoke.
I think you're correct on that. And it's just a shame, because if you spend your life trying to erase another person's history, it doesn't say much about you. And I think it's unfortunate. Here we are, you know, a couple of hundred years after, a civil war in which these issues should have been resolved, and we're still facing them today. And the good thing is, and one of the reasons that Black people have been able to survive in the way that they have is because we have very strong oral traditions. So even if the books were burned, they're not going to silence the voices unless they eradicate everybody. And the same thing is true about other ethnic groups as well. So it's really unfortunate. It breaks my heart. I would say it upsets me to no end. And I hope that we can get past this. We've got to do that as a nation if we're ever going to progress forward as a multicultural society.
Well, you know, you use the word eradicate, and I think, I think that's being attempted by trying to eradicate the vote, which is the voice of the community. It's eradicating voices that they just don't want to have any power.
Oh, it's a power grab, but we've been here before, and they're not going to silence people. People will move into the streets. You see it all over the globe. When people are subjugated to the point where they can't speak. So we're gonna have to get through this. I believe that we can. I think we're better than this. And I think that we have a bright future once we do get past it.
Now, do we have Regina? Emily?
Yes.
Oh,
I'm
Regina. Hello, hello, hello.
Hello, hello.
We had just a little...
Yeah. A little flip there.
Well, I always remind people, this is live radio. It does become a podcast later, but right now it's live radio, and therefore sometimes we have these funny hiccups. So, Pettis, well, you've introduced our guest. We just need your question. You were going to start with a question.
I am. First of all, hello, Regina. How are you?
I'm doing well, Pettis. I'm happy to be, well, not physically in the presence of you and Jill, but happy to be on the air with you both.
Well, happy to have you.
That's right.
Thank you.
And that's the advantage of technology when it works well. in the spirit of transparency, I want our audience to know that Regina and I have done some work together. We share a common friend and a guy by the name of Michael Lange, who we'll talk about a little bit later when we get into our show. And Michael Lange also taught at San Jose State along with Jill and I. So the three of us have a personal connection to Michael Lange, who was pivotal in helping Regina with her docudrama. So we'll talk about that in a little bit. But welcome, Gina. So let me begin with this. I was really fascinated by the way that you constructed this edition of your great 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 grandfather's story. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to call him your grandfather just to make it simpler.
Oh, that's fine. It is a mouthful.
But I was struck by, because you have it in several sections. You have your introduction, and then you have William Andrews' analysis and contributions. You then have the original text from 1825, as well as the 1855 text. And so I thought that was a beautiful way for you to keep your grandfather's words alive, more than just his memory. And you also gave the audience or the reader an opportunity to do some comparing and contrasting with the background that you both provided. So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what went into your thinking and about your 15-year journey to find your grandfather?
Okay, yes. Let me just say this. Yes, you're absolutely right. The book, you hear three voices. Bill Andrews, in the beginning we talk about how we came together. He is a scholar on African-American literature and African-American autobiography, so he's an expert. When I discovered William Grimes. I had no idea about the slave narrative genre. There are about 150 or so books out there that don't get a lot of attention unless they were very noteworthy, like Frederick Douglass or Harriet Jacobs, just to name a few. So when I discovered this book, and it was just by fluke, I had already been on a journey to discover my roots. And that seed was planted when I was in the fifth grade, way back in the spring of 1971, when I went home and I asked my mother, where are we from? And, you know, she gave me stories, of course, of what she knew about our heritage. To get to your point and or your question about how this book was pieced together, as it was, we have to fast forward 20 years from the time that I asked the question. My Aunt Catherine gave me a little bit about the family history, more than what my mother could, because she was a family historian. I'm in fifth grade, just learning about African-American history, and I'm not feeling good about it. I have to deal with confront slavery, and I even had to confront an African past I knew nothing about. The only thing I knew about Africa were exaggerated stereotypes. So anyway, I went on this journey of 15 years after I was a young mother. So I guess the year would be about 1991, at the time when there was no internet or any of those wonderful digital records that we have out there now. But this book came to me based on a clue. And the clue was, my Aunt Catherine told me, well, somebody in the family was associated with the Underground Railroad. His name was Grimes, and he was from New Haven, Connecticut. So 20 years after that class assignment, I was a young mother. I had two little girls, and I wanted them to know their history because I did not feel good about my own. There were just too many gaping holes in the family tree that my mother tried to reconstruct for me. But the clue that my aunt gave me was stayed with me. So this book came to me by just looking at everything I could on the Underground Railroad and the abolitionist movement. I wanted to know who this Grimes person was. And one day, I came across a book called The Underground Railroad First Person Narratives. And in there was this amazing clue in the Free New England section where Bloxon, who's the author or editor that put this all together, he said that he said that in New Haven, there was an escaped slave by the name of William Grimes who wrote his story in an autobiography, and that he was from Savannah, Georgia. He escaped on a brig that would take him to New York, and from there, he was put in contact with Underground Railroad workers who would take him to or direct him to New Haven. So those three little clues that my aunt gave me, the Grimes surname, the city of New Haven, and the fact that I was reading an Underground Railroad book, it was more than coincidental. So I found out that through Bloxon's bibliography that William Grimes had written his life story, and I had to go on a search to find it, and I did. And here it is that I'd have this slave narrative in my possession, or a republished version that I found at Cody's Books in Berkeley, which is no longer. And that was my introduction to a slave narrative. a memoir written by an ex-slave that read like no other memoir I had ever read. So I needed help with this.
And Regina, just to take a break, and I have a question for you on the other side of the break about your discovery of this volume, and then we'll have you continue. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. We're speaking with Regina Mason, who is an international speaker, author, film producer, and storyteller. She has spent 15 years researching the life of her great-great-great-grandfather, William Grimes, who penned his life story in 1825 that became the first fugitive slave narrative in American history. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Hello, K-Squid listeners. I'm Todd Hartman, and each weekday at 4 p.m., I bring you a different perspective on the news than you're likely to hear on most media outlets. Please join me on KSQD Santa Cruz, your ink spot on the dial for the Tom Hartman program, heard now for the first time ever in the Monterey Bay Area at 90.7 FM, weekdays at 4 p.m. That's Progressive Talking Conversation with me, Tom Hartman, weekdays at 4 p.m. on KSQD 90.7 FM. Tag, you're it.
If you're just joining us, I'm your host, Jill Cody, along with my co-host, Dr. Pettis Perry. Our topic today is The Life of William Grimes, the Runaway Slave. We're speaking with Regina Mason, who is an international speaker, author, film producer, and storyteller. Visit her website, reginamason.com, to find more about her book and her documentary. Regina, what I'd like to ask is just that emotional moment. What was it? Tell me about that moment that you found his narrative, his autobiography, and that you knew it was your grandfather. Just that emotion. What was that like?
Oh, my God. I could hardly speak. In fact, tears just flowed. Family Bible would definitely make the connection. I looked high and low for a direct connection. Couldn't find it. My Aunt Catherine found a family Bible that we had all thought was long gone, but it was in her sister's attic. And I just wept. Mm-hmm. All the research that I'd done and the time I spent trying to make this connection. And I had discovered his narrative before I could even make the connection. So in that moment, to solidify that he was indeed my great-great-great-grandfather was unbelievable. And then to see it in pages that were so frail, frayed.
Tell us where you went to see those pages. Where were they?
They were in my aunt's sister's. And let me just clarify that. Aunt Catherine is my mother's first cousin, but she was so much older than myself and my mother that we always gave her the title of aunt or auntie. And so she went to Portland because she had a hunch where that Bible was. She didn't even tell anybody. She just took the train up there and then came home with these Bible pages. And so it was a Memorial Day celebration. She had called in advance to say she was coming home with pages she had found tucked inside the Bible. And I was the first to look at it, and I knew immediately when I saw Grimes' name and I saw his wife's name that he was, in fact, related. And it was just mind-blowing.
Oh, I bet. I just get goosebumps thinking about it. Pettis?
Yeah, Regina, you have such a fabulous story. Can you tell us, you know, what you saw as the differences between your 1825 grandfather and your 1855 grandfather?
Oh, absolutely. Let me just say this. And, you know, Pettis, you asked me a question right off the bat, and I took the long road around telling how this book was put together. But it was Bill Andrews. I could not have told the story in the way that it now presents itself without Bill, because he was able to contextualize this narrative, and we're still learning more about it today. But Bill was the one that explain the difference between the two narratives. First of all, we now know that the 1855 edition was actually dictated to a printer in New Haven, Connecticut. And a scholar by the name of Susanna Ashton was able to find a newspaper clipping. And of course, we can find them all now in the digital age. But so the difference is this. The first edition, 1825, is raw. It is very raw and very difficult to navigate. It's episodic. And we know this based on letters that have been preserved that were in negotiation of his freedom. So William Grimes in 1825 was bitter. He was angry. Why? Because his final master found him after he was living for 9 years in New Haven, Connecticut. And what that meant was that he was forced, really, to give up the deed to his home because he had to pay for his freedom. And he, at the time, was a homeowner. And so the 1825 wounds are deep. For him to recount and relive the trauma that he went through just to tell his story, it was like reopening wounds. And if the words could bleed, they would have, just to relive the trauma that he suffered. So that is the difference.
And that last slave, master was his 10th, correct? He had 10 masters?
He had 10 masters. William Grimes was rebellious. He resisted the slave system at every turn. And he often, there were times when he would fake illness. There were times when he would just sabotage things just so that he could be sold to someone else, hoping in the end that in some way he can negotiate his freedom.
Now,
instead,
Regina,
of course, he had to escape. Yes.
Could you tell us some key stories? I use the phrase that when I read the book, I use the words prickle and crawl because that's what my skin did when I was reading his stories. So could you share a couple? And we might need to break in the middle, but we'd like to hear some.
Okay.
There's one about the hog, eating the hog entrails.
Right, being so starved for hunger. Here he is on this plantation, motherless. He's sold away from the arms of his mother, and he's trying to survive, okay, on his own at 10 years old, all right? He is starving. So he finds... hog
entrails.
Yes. I mean, even now, my skin is crawling.
I know.
And he decides that he's going to wash them. He's going to make a fire and cook them because he was so starved for meat. But they were spoiled, and he ate them anyway. And he was so sick, he says he'd like to have died. He also talks about being so starved for food that he even says he could have eaten his mother. That's how hungry he was. And that is really pushing, you know, that level of what slavery was and did to a people. So it pushed him that far over the edge that he could even say something like that. Well, that was appalling. That was something that a white audience could not and would not accept. But here it is coming out of the mouth of one who had been enslaved.
And the reason he was so hungry is that his masters didn't feed their slaves. I mean, he would talk about the lack of food.
Yes, they were given a peck a meal.
Peck a meal, that's right.
Fulfilled. Right. And, you know, he was sold to from, this was his second master he's talking about, and this was Master Thornton. And he said that Grimes stated that Master Thornton kept his slaves poorer and more hungry and starved than others did, other slave owners did on other plantations. So they were kept very poor. He talks about, you know, there are a lot of gruesome things, but what I found that was really interesting through all of this research that I'm doing is how these ties between these masters, they all knew each other. He was sold from one enslaver who knew the other enslaver, and on and on. So he remained in this, in the Thornton family for, oh, I guess, till he was about 20 years of age before he was sold deeper south to Savannah, Georgia. And he had six enslavers in Savannah, Georgia. And these were all six businessmen that they were merchants and they were business owners, wealthy, some of the wealthiest men in Savannah, Georgia. And they all knew each other. William Grimes was a mulatto. He's a light-skinned African-American. And when he was able to be dressed well, he represented the wealthy families in a very positive way. He was a driver, a coachman. He would take, and this is Dr. Kulluk, who was very prominent in Savannah. He would, William Grimes would drive the family to the Presbyterian church on Sunday. So he had to look a certain way. And William Grimes is the first African American to talk about racial passing. He at times would use his light skin to infiltrate meetings where he would be dressed like he was a reputable white person in society. And this one particular incident, he comes home rather late to the plantation. He has a little bit of economy. And Dr. Kulluk says to him, "Where have you been?" And William Grimes says, "Well, I went to the church meeting," and that was at the Presbyterian church. And he said, "How did you do that? How did you escape the guard?" And William Grimes said nothing to that. But he wrote about it. He said, "Because they always mistook me to be a white man." So here it is. Oh. We have him sort of representing this, this, the power of whiteness, you see. And I found that to be very, very interesting because we all know that race is a social construct, but he shows us by his appearance the power of whiteness, and that really struck me in such a unique way.
And his direct understanding and experience of what it's like to live in both worlds, the freedom of one and the lack of freedom for the other. You're listening to our guest, Regina Mason, who is an international speaker, author, film producer, and storyteller. She spent 15 years researching the life of her great-great-great-grandfather, William Grimes, who penned his story in 1825 so he could speak to us 196 years later. Are you listening? In addition, if you'd like to be added to our news group, you may text Be Bold America to 22828. Text Be Bold America to 22828. And thank you to those who've done so already. We really appreciate it. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Our society has coined expressions like philanthropist to encourage and hail people's charitable spirit. Look on the flip side of that shiny coin of generosity, however, and you'll find that its base substance is societal selfishness. After all, the need for charity only exists because we're tolerating intentional injustices and widespread inequality created by power elites. A society as supremely wealthy as ours ought not be relegating needy families and essential components of the common good to the whims of a few rich philanthropists. Yes, corporate and individual donations can help at the margins, but they don't fix anything. Thus, food banks, health clinics, etc. must constantly scrounge for more charity, while big donors have their charitable spirit subsidized with tax breaks that siphon money from our public treasury. Especially offensive to me is the common grandiose assertion by fat cat donors that charity is their way of, quote, giving back to society. Hello? If they can give so much, it's probably because they've been taking too much. As business columnist Andrew Ross Sorkin points out, all too often, charitable gifts are used to make up for the failure of companies to pay people a living wage and treat their workers with dignity. It's not just the unemployed who rely on food banks, but janitors, nannies, Uber drivers, checkout clerks, and others who work full-time but are so poorly paid they can't make ends meet. That's not a sad charity case, but a matter of criminal exploitation by wealthy elites. And the charitable thing to do is to outlaw it and require a living wage for all. This is Jim Hightower saying, as Sorkin puts it, the aim should be to create a society where we don't need places like food banks. We should be trying to put the food banks out of business.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Jill Cody, here with my co-host, Dr. Pettis Perry. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. And we're speaking with our bold guest, Regina Mason, who is an international speaker, author, film producer, and storyteller. And Pettis, before we go to talking about Michael Lynch, who was in the documentary, I just wanted to ask a kind of a personal question. Regina, can you tell us a little bit about his children? And I'm asking this because my husband, who's also, his name is also Grimes, last name is also Grimes, but he was pointing out to me that Quentin Grimes, in the is a professional basketball player for the New York Knicks, is also African-American, and wondered if he might be a descendant, too. So I'm just putting that out there.
Well, it's possible. William Grimes had many children, 18. And you know, if you're not listening now, weren't listening before, you're definitely listening now, because there's a lot of children, right? But 12 lived to adulthood.
Okay.
He had many sons, but not all of them carried the line forward. The women carried the line forward. So, you know, if your last name is Grimes, if you come out of Virginia, if you can, you know, or Texas or anything like that, there is a strong possibility that there is a connection.
Well, Quentin Grimes is from Houston, Texas.
Okay, well, there may be a connection there.
He may be a relative of yours.
He could be.
He could.
But several ways. He's from the European side or the African-American side.
Mm.
There's a strong possibility.
Yeah. Pettis.
This has been fascinating, your story, Regina. Every time we talk, I learn more about you and your grandfather. You know, you brought up the issue of being able to pass, and it's one of the struggles that the Black community has had to grapple with. You know, the brown paper bag test again, I think it was in Howard, or, you know, that there's a differentiation or a hierarchy, if you will, in the Black community based on color. And one of the lines I saw in your book was, I think it was your grandfather said he was three quarters white passing for a Negro, which is
absolutely
Which is, I think, a fabulous way of looking at it. And it's just one of the many psychological things that people of color, particularly African Americans, have had to contend with as he's, you know, as we live. I guess I have a question around the other slave narratives that were written around the time that your grandfather was alive. How did they differ from what your grandfather was able to accomplish?
Well, let me just say this. You see, William Grimes' narrative is the first fugitive slave narrative in American history. All right? And I would like to talk about how precedent-setting it is. But to answer your question, we can do a comparison to Frederick Douglass, who was an extraordinary, brilliant African-American man, abolitionist. We all know that name. And I'm not comparing William Grimes in terms of the brilliance and the intellect and so forth. I'm not equating that to be on par with Frederick Douglass. But here is the difference. Frederick Douglass was only 7 years old when the Grimes narrative appeared. Frederick Douglass was picked up by the abolitionist movement and immediately was swept up on a speaker circuit. So he was buffered. He was protected, okay, by the abolitionist movement. William Lloyd Garrison, Whittier, names like that. William Grimes did not have that luxury. William Grimes is on a perpetual treadmill of poverty in the North. That comes from Bill Andrews, who is the expert on, you know, African-American autobiography. So right away, we noticed that contrast. William Grimes' story came out 8 years before the formation of the American anti-slavery movement or society that was spearheaded by William Lloyd Garrison, who was the eminent abolitionist of the time. William Grimes' story came out before the Liberator newspaper, anti-slavery newspaper, before a Freedom's Journal, the first African-American newspaper. So this is why the Grimes narrative is so important today, because he's not writing to a white audience as the other narratives were, because they were endorsed by, corroborated by, sponsored by the white members of the abolitionist movement. William Grimes, in contrast, was not. So I hope I answered that question.
You did. If I recall from your book correctly, one of the other stark differences, he was unfiltered. So your grandfather...
Oh, absolutely, that's it.
Your what you read is your grandfather, whereas Douglass and some of the other people that wrote other slave narratives were working with editors and publishers who and sponsors who directed, at least to some degree, them towards the issues that were important to them as the producer, as the, or excuse me, the publisher, the editor, or the sponsor. So there was a very different setup, if you will, and a yes. freedom. And that's what I love about your grandfather's story, is that he was free to tell it his way, with his words, unfiltered, untarnished
Absolutely.
By other people.
Absolutely. And, you know, it is important to make that distinction. It is also important to recognize that the abolitionist movement, they of course wanted to end slavery, but they wanted to also show that the African American was capable of assimilating into society. William Grimes' narrative will have you to believe that it would be hard for any white person to accept and to understand the depth of deprivation and trauma that was placed upon slaves. So they walked a fine line. They wanted white people to embrace the African American in freedom, right? But as we know, freedom is one thing, equality is another. So white people in general, even those of, I would venture to say, if there was an abolitionist movement in place when Grimes wrote his narrative, they would have not been able to accept it, number one, or number two, they definitely would have manipulated it in a whole different direction.
Yeah, if I might, Jill, when he wrote the 1855 version, was there any pressure on him to be different, or is he just evoking what he was at that moment in time of his life?
Well, here's what it appears to me. In 1855, he's 70 years old. He is an old man. Money is always an issue, all right, in old age. You know, he wasn't the same man who can get out there and kind of etch out a living. Those years had gone by, and he clearly states in a newspaper article when he's looking for an original 1825 version of his narrative, it has fallen out of his head. He may have even sold off his last copy just to survive or to have a little bit of money. So he was very savvy with print culture, newspapers, and so forth, because he was exposed to that in Savannah, Georgia. He actually worked for a printer. He was, I think, and Bill Andrews thinks that he was produced this 1855 edition just to sell it to make money. And he says that in a newspaper article that he would hope that people would buy it so that he could have a little money put away for his future. So, and as I mentioned earlier, in 1855, we know that his book was dictated to someone, a printer in New Haven, Connecticut. So it wasn't the same raw William Grimes of 1825.
We're speaking with Regina Mason, who's an international speaker, author, film producer, and storyteller. She has spent 15 years researching the life of her great-great-great-grandfather, William Grimes, who penned his life story in 1825 that became the first fugitive slave narrative in American history. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Want a friend to hear this interview? Be Bold America is available as a podcast. Now your friends can listen for free from their favorite podcast platforms such as Apple, Google, Spotify, Radio Public, and many more. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Hello, this is Senator John Laird, and I would like to wish everyone involved with K-Squid a happy birthday. We really depend on K-Squid for news, items of what's going on in the community, and general awareness. So happy birthday.
Quench your thirst for knowledge and good music with the most refreshing radio station in town. KSQD Santa Cruz 90.7 FM brings you the latest news and the catchiest tunes. So turn that dial to K-Squid.
Today our topic is the life of William Grimes, the runaway slave. We're speaking with Regina Mason, who is an international speaker, author, film producer, and storyteller. Regina spent 15 years researching the life of her great-great-great-grandfather, who penned his life story in 1825 that became the first fugitive slave narrative in American history, so that he could speak to you 196 years later. Can you hear him? Find out more about her book and documentary at reginamason.com. So back to you, Regina. I think you were about ready to go on to another thought. Regina?
Yes.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Back to you. Yes.
Okay. So we left off with the comparing the 1825 edition to the 1855. And as I mentioned earlier, the 1825 edition remains the most important of the two, and probably the most important of the slave narratives for us to review today. Not just because it is the first, but really, William Grimes' narrative is like holding up a mirror to America. You read it and you come away thinking, my God, we are dealing with so many of the same problems that he talks about in his life story. You know, he is one of the first of the slave narratives, in fact, to talk explicitly about the jail system in Savannah, Georgia. He talks about such harsh cruelty. And really, when you think about it, that system of oppression runs deep in this country today, and we can carry all the way forward to over policing of black and brown bodies in America today. So that is one reason to understand how we got here. He writes lucidly about brutality, power, and control that overseers and slave drivers had on the plantations that he lived in the South. In urban Savannah, he had a free, more movement, okay? But he writes about the Savannah Watch, which was a group of white male citizens who were appointed to patrol the city streets in order to oversee the movements of black people, those who were free and those who were in... Revisit his narrative, there are several parallels today, really.
I think you're right. Yeah, Jeff Sessions, I don't know if it was yesterday or very recently, talked about, he was talking to the Sheriff's Association and made a comment about the sheriffs being uniquely an Anglo-American artifact. You know, and it goes to your statement about policing and how police are used in those days and now. Jill, did you want
to? Well, just to add to that, I wanted to say that our policing today is based on the slave patrols.
Exactly.
Of William Grimes's time.
Yeah.
It's that, you know, that's where policing grew out of. And I also, when I was reading his book, And you know, really empathizing with what his life must have been like, I get so furious when I hear those who at best are gaslighting and worse, just lying to change history when they say, oh, the slaves liked it. They had housing. They had food. They had health care. They had none of that. Go ahead, Regina.
That's why the slave narratives are so important when you get a first-hand or eyewitness to history, especially when you can have someone tell it in their own words. I want to say this about the precedent-setting aspect of the Grimes narrative. William Grimes is the first person to write about enslavement in the South as he experienced it, okay? He's the first person to write about it from the perspective of one who has been enslaved. Prior to that, it was those who controlled the narrative that wrote about enslavement. And as you said, Jill, that it was the best condition for them, you know, that they were of an inferior race, so that we needed to rescue them, so to speak. They were ripe for this kind of labor and so forth. They had, even using the Bible to justify enslavement. So William Grimes is inserted, boldly inserted his voice in the middle of that to say, no, this is how it is. This is my lived experiences.
And this is so important for Black History Month, too, that, you know, everyone to be able to have the opportunity to read something so raw and so direct. And that's why I press upon him speaking to us from 196 years ago, because that's just what he is. It's his words. He's speaking directly to us. And we haven't had that before. I know I didn't have in my education. And I did want to say that at least you were in fifth grade, and you know, you may not have felt very good about what you were learning, but you were lucky to learn it. Right now, there are many efforts around the country to just take that out of elementary school.
Well, let's be clear about this. I didn't learn it.
No, I meant
in fifth grade. The seedlings were planted.
The seeding.
I started to
right.
to. I started to pay attention into about. To the world unfolding around me. I grew up in the era, the height of the civil rights movement that gave way to the black nationalism, black nationalists, okay? Of course, I'm in Oakland. The Black Panthers were my community. I wanted to know, and, you know, what was all this outrage? So I had to go on this search. It took me years, obviously. It wasn't until I got to high school. I went to Berkeley High, and Berkeley High had a fabulous African-American studies program. In fact, it was the first of its kind on the high school level in the nation. I had wonderful teachers that were able to put books in front of me where I could understand slavery, American history, put it into perspective. And so it whet my appetite. And ever since then, I've just been reading and reading and reading. And that's what people have to do. And I have to say this, genealogy is so important. You know, it's one thing to tell and impress upon people the power of history, and rightfully so, because I believe history is everything when it's factual history, okay, when you're given the truth to, you know, before you. Genealogy has that same power, all right? Genealogy, when done correctly, will cause you to want to know your ancestors' struggle in this country. And with that, and pairing it with American history, you get a much broader understanding of where you come from. And that makes a huge difference in understanding how America became and developed, and what America developed into.
What it is
when
today.
You know, mm-hmm. Absolutely. When you know your family's role, then you are more empowered. You are more knowledgeable when you use genealogy correctly. And that's for everyone. That is for everyone. Every walk of life, every ethnicity. It's empowering.
Every heritage. Now, in the two and a half minutes we have left, I know one thing we talk about at the end is what our guest would suggest for our listeners to keep doing, stop doing, and start doing regarding your topic. But I do know that Pettis wanted to talk a minute about, or, you know, quickly about Michael Lange. Pettis?
Yes.
Regina, I'm sorry we don't have time today to really talk about your film in the way that it should be discussed, but I'm hoping that the audience will look at it. It's a very powerful film, and Michael Lange was cast as the Elder Grimes. Can you talk just a quick minute about Michael? And
not even a minute.
30 seconds.
Okay, Michael Ange, Bay Area icon, peace builder, advocate for change. He was an amazing actor that through his art, he was able to shine a light on truth. And so I saw him in a play in San Francisco, and I said, I got to have him for the lead. I knew Michael's family, but I had not seen his work. And he was the perfect person to play William Grimes.
Well, we miss him. We miss him very much. And in the last minute, what would you have listeners keep doing?
I would have listeners keep reading. Get to the bottom of this society that we live in now that looks so un-American at times. Read history. Understand history so that you can speak about it intelligently and go to the facts. Get involved with peace building and reconciliation, because the truth told, we're all in this together. And the story of who we are is not only central to our individual survival, but to our collective understanding and appreciation of each other. So start with your own story, your own family history, your own genealogy.
And start doing? Quickly, I have 10 seconds.
Yes, start doing. Look at Gina's Journey, The Search of William Grimes.
Okay. Thank you,
I
Regina.
Put that plug in.
Thank you. Thank you for being with us. Pettis and I really enjoyed this today. I wish we had more time. As you can tell, we're running out of it.
Yes.
Thank you for being our bold and impressive guest. We appreciate you and what you have achieved to bring the first fugitive slave narrative in American history to us all. Thank you, Regina.
Thank you, Jill. Thank you, Pettis.
What's up next? What's up next on Be Bold America? We'll be discussing Laboratories of Autocracy, a wake-up call from behind the lines on Sunday, February 27th at 5 p.m. Pettis and I will have the honor to be speaking with author David Pepper. David Pepper graduated from Yale Law School and served as the chairman of Ohio's statewide Democratic Party. He's the author of three political thrillers and Laboratories of Autocracy. In Laboratories of Autocracy, David Pepper states there's a bigger problem than the big lie. It is the anonymous, often corrupt politicians in state houses across the country who pose the greatest dangers to American democracy. So join us on Sunday, February 27th at 5 p.m. to hear about the more invisible threat to democracy, state houses. Remember, Be Bold America is available as a podcast. Now you may listen to the show anytime for free, wherever you download your podcast. And I want to give a special thank you to Be Bold America's program engineer, Emily Donham, to our station program director, Howard Feldstein, and again to our bold guest, Regina Mason. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz. Many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online at KSQD.org. Stay tuned for Intersections with Seth Shapiro. My name is Jill Cody.
And I'm Dr. Pettis Perry.
And thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start.